A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. So I really enjoyed listening to the episode last night about how hotels rig up their smart gear. And I mentioned that my wife, Hannah, who's an architect and is working on a project for a hotel, is actually looking at the stuff, which is what really led to the question. But then we got into talking about the actual mechanics of it. And we've done a few episodes about this topic. The very first one in our series was me asking, way back in the early days of the podcast, wait, we have places that use smart home systems or smart systems for controlling things like lights, like airports and museums, that clearly are not relying upon Home Assistant for the backbone, because they would be driven crazy and they wouldn't accept it. This got us talking into what kind of systems are used for smart automation in the field. And the episode last night was actually just kind of a subset of that conversation. We talked about specifically hotel technology. And I was thinking today about what you mentioned, and a lot of things made sense to me. We talked about the distinguishing thing in hotels being that the guest might have control over the devices, as opposed to a museum, where the guest isn't going to be turning on the corridor lights in a hotel. The guest has temporary access to a space. And therefore, it's a system that has to be remote controllable, but also end user controllable, which brings with it interesting questions of federacy and security that you mightn't have in other environments. But you talked about something in the hotels that you have basically a kind of distributed architecture. You have controllers in rooms on floors leading back to a brain, and even one layer above that, a chain management system looking at actual revenue data and doing a supervisory layer. So it's a pretty complicated orchestra. But I was thinking that actually makes a ton of sense from reliability. I don't think anyone who's worked in IT would disagree with the idea that if you're doing something critical and important, the easiest way to improve the reliability of any device living on a network is to buy yourself a long cable. Because even with the greatest advances in Wi-Fi technology and very interesting and useful protocols like Zigbee and Matter, you're always going to be contending with crowded networks, radio frequencies, and just a whole bunch of things that you can defeat by simply purchasing long spools of cable. And this system in which we have things bundled together into rooms creates a system whereby the control surface can actually survive disconnections, which is pretty cool. But even if you were not going that far, I thought today, as I was going to opening up the fridge for lunch, could you actually put in this stuff in a house? Like, we are currently renting, as you know, but we have a plan to own and buy a place, and we're both quite DIY friendly people. And especially, this is actually where we have a bit of confluence in our interests. And there's a few things that I was thinking about. Number one, if we talked about putting in wired, let's say plugs, switches, the current rental we have, which is how I got into Home Assistant, the switches are basically all Wi-Fi 2E switches. And this has actually been by far the most frustrating, brittle, broken part of the entire system. My stuff is all Zigbee. It actually works pretty well. But these 2E plugs are continuously breaking. 2E is buggy. You control it with a smartphone app, and you just feel like this is not a smart way to do smart home automation, period. So the system last night that we talked about in hotels, we talked about protocols like Modbus, KNX, specialty suppliers. We're talking about both different, it's kind of a parallel universe to consumer IoT that is actually more established. Now, my question is the following. If you're building a house and you're going to be putting down electrical stuff anyway, can you actually deploy your own smart home? Because Another subset of the world of IoT is the ultra wealthy. You have people who, you know, rig up amazing smart systems on yachts and stuff like that. And the difference between this use case and that is they might be putting in OT stuff and, you know, hotel style switches, but they're probably not doing it themselves. And they probably also aren't worrying about the cost of switches. So let's talk about your more average person, but who is technically minded, and they're building a place and they're thinking, well, I love my home assistant. I want to keep using home assistant and not one of these walled gardens, because that's another issue is I feel like home assistant, for all its deficiencies, actually gets one thing really right, which is that the course of technology trends towards integration. If you talk about things like Sonos for smart speakers, we talk about all the different facets. If everyone creates a walled garden around just their things, consumers end up with 10 or 20 apps to just manage their home and they give up on it. So I feel like the more manufacturers try to create walled gardens, the quicker the whole concept of a manufacturer-specific walled garden will come crashing down. So the home assistant concept is a good one, I think, if we can get around the usability things. But if we wanted to lay down in our imaginary home, we wanted to put down cabling, we need a few things. We're going to need a place to buy whatever it is, it's Luvox or whatever supports the protocol for switches for light controllers. We're going to need the cabling to wire this stuff up back to the controller, and that's non-negotiable. This is the whole point, right, is we're putting down cabling instead of wiring. And then we're going to need that box, whatever it's called, the controller, that might not even be Ethernet connections. We're connecting back on an entirely different cable. And then we need to go from that box to anything running on our conventional network, which is, you know, connected with Ethernet. So let's say a switch. So we're going to need a few things. And what I'd love to know, Herman and Corin, is what are we talking about in terms of cost? Where would someone even buy these things? Like if I'm buying a new home, and I say, I want to put in my own switches, I'm going to need, you know, a few hundred meters of this specific cabling. I'm going to need the brain. Where do you go? I haven't seen this stuff on AliExpress. I presume it's a bit more specialist than that. I also presume a lot of people are going to be doing this with systems integrators. And that's where our use case is a bit different. We're talking about the determined DIYer who's also going to be doing the actual wiring themselves. So let's look at the manufacturers, the standards, the costs, and the feasibility of connecting OT systems or traditional non-consumer grade IoT into a IoT network like Home Assistant and how it can actually be done.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good follow-up. He's been thinking about the hotel automation episode, and he's got a practical question. If you're building a house and you're technically minded and you're already doing the electrical work anyway, can you deploy the kind of industrial grade wired automation that hotels use instead of consumer Wi-Fi and Zigbee stuff? And specifically, where do you buy it? What does it cost? And can you actually connect it to Home Assistant?
Oh, this is the good stuff. This is where we get to talk about the parallel universe.
The parallel universe of things that actually work.
And Daniel's framing is spot on. He mentioned that his Wi-Fi Tuya switches are the most brittle part of his setup, and that's not a coincidence. The fundamental insight here is that consumer IoT and professional building automation evolve completely separately. They're solving different problems with different assumptions about what reliable means.
Before we dive into that, quick note. Today's episode is being scripted by DeepSeek V4 Pro. Don't mess this up.
So, the professional universe. Daniel mentioned Modbus, KNX, and he name-dropped Loxone. These are not household names unless your household is a 40-story office tower. But they're not exotic either. KNX, for example, is an open standard that's been around since 1999. It grew out of earlier European installation bus standards, and it's ratified as both a European standard, EN5090, and an international standard, ISO/IEC 14543. This is not some startup's proprietary protocol that might vanish in 3 years.
So this predates the entire consumer smart home wave by a solid 15 years.
And that matters because the design philosophy is completely different. In the consumer world, you've got this assumption that everything talks over IP, everything connects to a router, and if something goes wrong, you reboot it or fiddle with an app. In the KNX world, the bus is the network. It's a dedicated twisted pair cable, usually green, that carries both power and data to every device on the bus. You don't need IP addresses, you don't need Wi-Fi, you don't need a router. The bus is self-contained.
Daniel's point about buying yourself a long cable is literally the founding principle of KNX.
And because it's a dedicated bus, you don't have to worry about your neighbor's Wi-Fi blasting through your walls or your microwave oven knocking out your light switches. The bus operates at a very low data rate, something like 9700 bits per second, which sounds laughable by modern standards, but it's more than enough for sending turn on the lights, or the temperature is 22 degrees. And that low data rate makes it incredibly robust over long distances.
Let's get concrete. Daniel's hypothetical. He's building a house. He's got Home Assistant running on a server somewhere. He wants to put in wired switches, wired sensors, wired everything. Where does he actually start with KNX?
He needs three things. A KNX power supply, a KNX bus cable, and KNX devices. The power supply is a little DIN rail module that provides 30 volts DC to the bus. It's specifically designed to decouple the bus from mains power. You need one per bus segment, and a segment can handle up to 64 devices. For a house, one segment is usually plenty. KNX bus cable. It's a specific type, usually designated YCYM 2x2 by 0.8. It's a twisted pair, shielded, and it's rated for running alongside mains voltage cable in the same conduit, which is a huge practical advantage. An electrician can pull the KNX cable right alongside the power cables, and the shielding handles the interference. Cost-wise, you're looking at somewhere around 50 to 80 cents per meter. So for a whole house, you might spend a few hundred dollars on cable. It's not a major line item.
Then the devices themselves. What does a KNX light switch cost compared to a consumer Zigbee switch?
This is where the sticker shock hits. A basic KNX push-button switch from a manufacturer like Jira or Joom is going to run you somewhere between 80 and 150 euros. That's per switch. A KNX dimming actuator that sits in your electrical panel and actually controls the lights is another 150 to 300 euros. And you need one actuator channel per lighting circuit. So if you've got 10 lighting circuits in your house, you're looking at a couple thousand euros just in actuators.
We're talking about a system that costs, what, 5 to 10 times what a consumer setup costs.
But here's the thing. That KNX switch will still be working in 20 years. The company that made it, Jira or Jung or Siemens, has been in business for decades and will probably be in business for decades more. The protocol is backward compatible all the way to 1999. When you install KNX, you're installing infrastructure, not gadgets.
There's a philosophical difference there that I think is worth underlining. In consumer IoT, you're buying products. In KNX, you're buying a system. The products are components of the system, and they're designed to be replaced individually over decades without breaking the whole thing.
And that's why hotels and airports and museums use this stuff. They can't afford to have a light switch stop working because a cloud server went down or a company went out of business. The bus runs locally with no internet dependency whatsoever. Every device has its own little microcontroller that runs its own logic. If the KNX bus is up, the system works, even if your Home Assistant server is on fire.
Let's talk about the other protocol Daniel mentioned.
Modbus is even older than KNX. It dates back to 1979, developed by Modicon for industrial programmable logic controllers. It's dead simple. It's a serial protocol, originally running over RS-232 or RS-485, and it basically just reads and writes registers. A register might hold the state of a relay, or a temperature reading, or a set point. The elegance of Modbus is that it's so simple you can implement it on anything. It's still widely used in industrial automation, HVAC systems, power meters, that kind of thing.
In a residential context.
Less common for light switches, but very common for things like energy monitoring, heat pump control, ventilation systems. If you're installing a serious HVAC system in your house, there's a good chance the controller speaks Modbus. And the nice thing is that Modbus is so simple that integrating it with Home Assistant is trivial. You can buy a Modbus to Ethernet gateway for $50, plug it into your network, and Home Assistant can read and write registers directly.
You might end up with a hybrid. KNX for lighting and blinds and basic switching, Modbus for HVAC and energy, and then Home Assistant sitting on top tying it all together with Zigbee for the more consumery stuff like door sensors and motion detectors.
That's a very sensible architecture, and it's exactly what a lot of high-end residential installers do. They're not using one protocol for everything, they're picking the right tool for each job.
Now Daniel also name-dropped LockZone, which is a bit different from KNX. What's their deal?
LockZone is an Austrian company founded in 2009, and they're kind of the bridge between the professional world and the prosumer world. They sell a complete smart home system that's based around their mini server, which is a little DIN rail computer that runs everything. Their devices communicate over a proprietary protocol called LockZone Link, which uses standard Cat7 cable. So you're wiring your house with Ethernet cable, not a special bus cable.
Which is appealing because Cat7 is cheap, and every electrician knows how to terminate it.
LockZone's whole pitch is simplicity through vertical integration. They make the server, they make the switches, they make the actuators, they make the sensors. It all works together, out of the box. And their programming environment, LockZone Config, is designed to be used by electricians and installers, not software engineers. It's a graphical flow-based programming system where you drag blocks around and connect them.
It's like the Apple of building automation.
That's a really good comparison. It's more expensive than a DIY KNX setup, but you're paying for the integration and the simplicity. A typical LockZone mini server is around 600 euros. Their switches, the LockZone Touch, are about 200 euros each. Their actuators are similarly priced to KNX actuators. For a whole house system, you might be looking at 5,000 to 10,000 euros in hardware, plus installation.
The big question Daniel's asking, can these things talk to Home Assistant?
Yes, and this is where things have gotten really interesting in the last few years. KNX has a native integration in Home Assistant. It's been there for years, it's mature, and it works over IP. You need a KNX IP interface, which is a little device that bridges the KNX bus to your Ethernet network. That costs about 200 to 300 euros. Once that's in place, Home Assistant can see every KNX device on the bus, read their states, and send commands. It's bidirectional and it's local. No cloud, no middleman. LockZone is a bit more complicated. There's no official Home Assistant integration, but there's a very active community integration that works through LockZone's web API. It's not as seamless as the KNX integration, but it's functional. You can read sensor values and control outputs. The bigger question with LockZone is whether you even need Home Assistant. LockZone's own automation engine is quite capable. You might use Home Assistant just as a front end, or for integrating non-LockZone devices.
That raises an interesting question. If you go all in on KNX or LockZone, what's the role of Home Assistant? Is it still the brain, or does it become more of a supervisory layer?
In a well-designed KNX system, Home Assistant is not the brain. The brain is distributed across the KNX devices themselves. A KNX switch talks directly to a KNX actuator on the bus. That communication happens in milliseconds and doesn't touch Home Assistant at all. Home Assistant is the integration hub and the user interface. It's what lets you control your KNX lights from your phone or create automations that involve non-KNX devices or view your energy dashboard.
Which is exactly the architecture Daniel described from the hotel episode. Distributed intelligence at the edge with a central coordinator for cross-system logic and user access.
And this is the thing that consumer IoT gets wrong, in my opinion. Everything is star topology back to a hub or a cloud server. If the hub goes down, nothing works. In a proper distributed bus system, the hub is optional for basic operation. The lights still turn on when you press the switch, even if your server is a smoking crater.
Let's talk about cost more concretely. Daniel asked what this actually looks like for a real house. Let's say a 2,000 square foot house, 3 bedrooms, open plan living area. Maybe 20 lighting circuits, 10 switch locations, some blinds, a few heating zones.
For a KNX system, you're looking at roughly 20 lighting circuits means you need a 20-channel actuator or a couple of smaller actuators. That's about 1,500 to 2,000 euros. 10 switch locations, each with a 4-button KNX switch. At 100 euros per switch, that's 1,000 euros. You need a KNX power supply, about 200 euros. A KNX-IP interface, another 250. A few hundred meters of bus cable, call it 300 euros. You're at around 3,500 to 4,000 euros just for the core lighting control. That doesn't include the actual light fixtures, just the control system.
If you add blinds.
KNX blind actuators are another few hundred euros per blind, plus the motors themselves, which are a separate cost. Heating control, you'd add KNX thermostats or use Modbus to talk to your heat pump. That's another 1,000 or so. All in, you're probably at 6,000 to 8,000 euros for a comprehensive KNX system in that house.
The consumer equivalent? Zigbee switches and relays.
A Zigbee in-wall relay is about 15 to 20 euros. A Zigbee switch is 30 to 50 euros. For the same 20 circuits and 10 switches, you're looking at maybe 800 to 1,000 euros total. So KNX is roughly 5 to 8 times more expensive. But again, you're comparing a 20-year infrastructure investment to consumer electronics that might be obsolete in 5 years.
There's also the labor question. Daniel said he's DIY friendly and would do the wiring himself. Is KNX something a competent DIYer can actually install?
Yes, with some caveats. The physical installation is straightforward. The bus cable is low voltage, so in most jurisdictions you don't even need an electrician's license to pull it, though you do need an electrician for the mains voltage side of things. The topology is a free topology. You can daisy chain, star, tree, whatever. You just can't make loops. The programming is done with a software tool called ETS, the engineering tool software. That's a professional tool, and it requires a license. The light version is about 200 euros. There's a learning curve. It's not like pairing a Zigbee device where you just press a button. You need to understand group addresses and device parameters. But it's not rocket science either. If you're the kind of person who's comfortable configuring Home Assistant YAML, you can learn ETS.
The barrier is more about knowledge and willingness to learn than about requiring specialized equipment or certifications.
And there's a very active community around KNXDIY. There are forums, YouTube channels, even online courses. It's niche, but the resources are there.
Daniel also asked about where to actually buy this stuff. He said he hasn't seen it on AliExpress.
You can find some KNX stuff on AliExpress, but I wouldn't recommend it. The reputable sources are electrical wholesalers and specialized online shops. In Europe, places like Voltus, Ebmarkt, and Ivory Egg. These are B2B suppliers that also sell to individuals. You can just create an account and order. In North America, it's a bit harder because KNX is less common there. Loxone sells direct through their website and through a network of installers. You can buy their gear as an end user, but their support model assumes you're an installer.
That's an important practical point. If you're in North America, KNX is a less obvious choice than in Europe, simply because the supply chain and installer ecosystem are smaller.
In North America, you might look at something like Lutron's professional systems instead. Lutron Homeworks is the rough equivalent of KNX in the US market. It's a wired dealer-installed system that's been around for decades and is extremely reliable. But Lutron is more locked down than KNX. You typically need to be a certified dealer to program it. There are third-party integrations with Home Assistant, but they're reverse-engineered, not officially supported.
The open, DIY-friendly professional system is really more of a European phenomenon, driven by KNX being an open standard.
KNX is the standout here because it's truly open. Any manufacturer can make KNX devices, and there are over 500 manufacturers in the KNX Association. You've got everything from premium German brands like Jura and Jung to more affordable options like MDT and Zinio. Competition keeps prices somewhat in check, and you're not locked into one vendor's ecosystem.
Let's pivot to something Daniel mentioned in passing. The ultra-wealthy yacht automation world. Is that a different set of protocols entirely?
Yachts use a lot of the same industrial protocols. Modbus is huge in marine automation. So is CAN Bus, which is the protocol used in cars. NMEA 2000 is a marine-specific standard built on CAN Bus. But the philosophy is the same. Wired, distributed, no single point of failure, no cloud dependency. The difference is that yacht systems are even more redundant because failure at sea is a lot more consequential than a light not turning on in your living room.
The cost is in a completely different universe.
A yacht automation system from a company like Crestron or Lutron's marine division can run into the hundreds of thousands. But the underlying principles are identical to what we're talking about with KNX in a house.
The average technically minded person building a house can tap into the same reliability principles without the yacht budget.
You're not getting the triple redundant servers and the 24/7 support contract, but you're getting the same bus topology, the same distributed intelligence, the same 20-year lifespan. That's the democratization that's happened in the last decade. These professional protocols are now accessible to individuals.
There's a question of future-proofing here, too. If I install KNX today, am I locking myself into something that'll feel dated in 10 years?
I'd argue the opposite. KNX is more future-proof than any consumer protocol precisely because it's so simple and so standardized. The KNX bus doesn't care what's happening in the world of Wi-Fi or Matter or whatever comes next. It's just a bus. It sends telegrams. A telegram says group address 5/1/3 is now value 1. That's it. That abstraction layer means you can swap out the controller, the user interface, the integration hub, without touching the underlying infrastructure. In 10 years, you might be running Home Assistant version 20 on whatever hardware exists then, talking to your KNX bus through whatever IP interface exists then, and the switches on your walls will still just be KNX switches doing their thing.
That's a sharp contrast to consumer systems where the protocol and the hardware are tightly coupled. If you buy a Philips Hue system, the bulbs and the hub and the protocol are all one ecosystem. If Philips decides to change the protocol, you're replacing everything.
Or if they shut down the cloud service, which has happened multiple times in consumer IoT. Companies go under, servers go offline, and suddenly your hardware is e-waste. With KNX, the bus is the bus. Even if every KNX manufacturer went out of business tomorrow, the devices in your walls would still work. You just wouldn't be able to buy new ones, but they'd keep working.
Let's talk about the integration with Home Assistant more practically. Daniel's got a Home Assistant set up. He's comfortable with it. If he installs KNX, what does that actually look like day to day?
You install the KNX IP interface, which is a little DIN rail module that connects to the KNX bus on one side and Ethernet on the other. You give it an IP address. In Home Assistant, you add the KNX integration, point it at that IP address, and it just works. You don't need to configure individual devices. Home Assistant discovers them automatically through the bus. Every switch, every actuator, every sensor shows up as an entity. You can then build your dashboards, your automations, your scenes, exactly as you would with Zigbee or Z-Wave devices. KNX telegrams propagate across the bus in milliseconds. The IP interface adds maybe 10 to 20 milliseconds of latency. So from the moment you tap a button in the Home Assistant app to the light turning on, you're looking at maybe 30 to 50 milliseconds total. That's faster than most consumer Zigbee setups, and dramatically faster than anything that goes through a cloud server.
Reliability-wise, if Home Assistant crashes, the KNX bus doesn't care. The physical switches still work. The basic automations that are programmed directly into the KNX devices still work.
That's the key. You program the critical stuff directly into the KNX devices using ETS. Things like this switch controls that light, or, if the motion sensor triggers, turn on the hallway lights. Those are KNX group address assignments. They run on the bus, not on Home Assistant. Home Assistant handles the higher level stuff. When everyone leaves the house, turn off all the lights and arm the alarm. That kind of cross-system automation is where Home Assistant shines, and if it fails, you lose those conveniences but not basic functionality.
That separation of concerns is so clean. The bus handles reliability, critical local control. The server handles integration and intelligence. Neither depends on the other for its core function.
It's the exact architecture Daniel described from the hotel episode, scaled down to a single-family home. Room-level controllers for local functions, a building-level controller for cross-room coordination, and then whatever supervisory layer you want on top.
What's the catch? Why isn't everyone doing this?
Cost, complexity, and awareness. The cost we've covered, it's 5 to 8 times more expensive up front. For a lot of people, that's a non-starter, even if the lifetime cost might actually be lower because you're not replacing failed devices every few years. The complexity is real. ETS is not an app you download and figure out in an afternoon. You need to invest time in learning it, and awareness is probably the biggest factor. Most people simply don't know KNX exists. They walk into a hardware store and see Philips Hue and think that's what smart lighting is.
There's a fourth reason that's more subtle. Most people don't stay in the same house for 20 years. The long-term reliability argument is less compelling if you're going to sell the house in 5 years.
That's a fair point, though I'd argue that a well-documented KNX system could actually be a selling point for a house, especially to technically minded buyers. It's like having proper structured wiring instead of just Wi-Fi everywhere. It signals that the house was built with care.
Let's get into some specifics about manufacturers. If someone is convinced and wants to start planning a KNX system, who should they be looking at?
For switches and visible devices, the big names are Jira, Jun, and Basalt. Jira's E2 and E3 lines are the most common. They're solid, well-designed, and available in dozens of finishes. Jun's F-series and A-series are also excellent. Basalt A is the high-end option, very minimalist, very expensive. For actuators and infrastructure devices that sit in the electrical panel, MDT is probably the best value proposition. They're a German company that makes reliable, no-frills, DIN rail devices at prices that are noticeably lower than Jira or Siemens. Zinio is a Spanish company that's also very competitive on price and makes some interesting multifunction devices.
The IP interface.
The KNX IP interface is a standardized device. You can get one from any manufacturer. MDT, Jira, WineZero, they all make them. They're functionally identical. Pick whichever is cheapest or in stock. The one thing to be aware of is that there's also something called a KNX IP router, which is slightly different. A router connects two KNX bus segments and also provides IP connectivity. An interface just connects one bus segment to IP. For a single-family home, an interface is all you need.
The software side. ETS is the programming tool. What versions are we talking about?
ETS 6 is the current version as of 2026. ETS 5 is still widely used and perfectly fine. The light version of ETS 6 is around 200 euros and it's limited to 64 devices per project, which is enough for most houses. The professional version is 1,000 euros and supports unlimited devices. For a DIYer, the light version is almost always sufficient.
64 devices sounds like a lot, but if you've got 20 actuators, 10 switches, a few sensors, an IP interface, a power supply, you're already at 35 or 40. Add blinds and heating and you could hit that limit.
You could, but it's rare in a typical house. And the limit is per project, not per bus. You can have multiple projects talking to the same bus if you really need to, though that gets complicated. For most houses, 64 is plenty.
Let's talk about Loxone again for a moment, because I think it's a compelling alternative for a certain kind of person. If ETS sounds intimidating, Loxone's programming tool is genuinely approachable.
Loxone Config is the closest thing to an easy button in the professional automation world. It's a graphical programming environment where you literally drag and drop function blocks and connect them with lines. A light control block has inputs for switches and outputs for lights. You wire them up visually. It's intuitive in a way that ETS is not. The trade-off is that you're locked in the Loxone's ecosystem. Your switches, your actuators, your sensors, they all have to be Loxone or Loxone compatible. You can't mix and match manufacturers the way you can with KNX.
The cost difference?
Roughly comparable to mid-range KNX. Loxone hardware is not cheap, but it's not Basalte expensive either. The mini server is 600 euros, their switches are around 200, their actuators are competitive with MDT. Where Loxone gets expensive is if you want to integrate third-party stuff. They sell various extension modules for Modbus, for DALI lighting, for one-wire temperature sensors, and each of those adds cost.
That's another protocol Daniel didn't mention, but that's relevant here.
DALI is the Professional Lighting Control Protocol. It stands for Digital Addressable Lighting Interface. It's a two-wire bus specifically for controlling luminaires and LED drivers. It's widely used in commercial buildings and it's often paired with KNX. KNX handles the switches and the high-level control, and then a KNX DALI gateway translates between the two buses. DALI lets you do things like individual dimming control of every light fixture, color temperature adjustment, and emergency lighting testing. It's overkill for most houses, but if you're doing a lot of architectural lighting, it's worth considering.
A truly maximalist approach would be KNX for switching and sensors, DALI for lighting control, Modbus for HVAC and energy, all tied together with Home Assistant.
That's not a hypothetical. That's what high-end residential systems look like. It sounds complicated, but each piece is simple and reliable in its own domain. The complexity is in the integration, and that's exactly where Home Assistant excels.
There's a philosophical point here that I think Daniel's getting at with his course of technology trends towards integration. Comment. The consumer smart home industry keeps trying to build walled gardens. Apple HomeKit, Amazon Alexa, Google Home, Samsung SmartThings. Each one wants to be the platform. And the result is that consumers end up with fragmentation and confusion. Meanwhile, the professional world just uses open standards and integration layers, and it works.
The professional world figured out decades ago that no single protocol can do everything well. KNX is great for distributed switching and control. DALLI is great for lighting. Modbus is great for industrial equipment and energy metering. BACNet is great for large-scale building management. MBUS is great for utility metering. The solution isn't to make one protocol that replaces all of them. The solution is to have good gateways between them.
Matter is the consumer world's attempt to solve this, and it's been.
Matter is trying to do what KNX did 30 years ago, but over IP and with a much more complicated security model and a much broader scope. I think Matter will eventually get there, but it's still in its awkward adolescence. KNX is the grown-up in the room. It's boring, it's stable, and it works.
If Daniel and Anna are building a house, and they're serious about this, what's the practical roadmap?
Decide on the backbone protocol. KNX if you want maximum openness and manufacturer choice. Loxone if you want simplicity and don't mind the ecosystem lock-in. Design the bus topology. Where do the cables run? Where does the DIN rail panel go? This is something you typically work on with an electrician or a KNX consultant, but a determined DIYer can do it themselves with enough research. Buy the gear. Get it from a European online shop if you're doing KNX. Pull the cable and mount the devices. This is the physical install, and it's the most labor-intensive part. Program the system with ETS or Loxone Config. Integrate with Home Assistant.
Make sure your partner is on board with the budget and the aesthetic choices for the switches.
That might be the hardest step of all. Switch design is surprisingly contentious. Jira and Jung make beautiful stuff, but it's a particular aesthetic. Modern European minimalism. If your house has a more traditional look, you might need to look at some of the other KNX manufacturers that do more classic designs.
Daniel mentioned that Hannah is an architect, so she's probably got opinions about switch aesthetics.
Architects love KNX. The switches are sleek, the plates come in every finish imaginable, and the whole system can be completely invisible if you want it to be. You can put the actuators in a utility closet and just have the switches on the walls. Be these minimalist panels that don't look like technology at all.
Let's talk about one more practical concern. When something goes wrong with a consumer smart home, you reboot the hub, you repair the device, you Google the error message. What happens when a KNX system has a problem?
KNX problems are rare, but when they happen, they're usually physical. A cable gets damaged, a device loses power, the bus voltage drops below the threshold. ETS has diagnostic tools built in. You can monitor the bus traffic, see which devices are responding, check the bus voltage. It's more like troubleshooting a network than troubleshooting an app. The good news is that because the system is so simple at the physical layer, the problems are usually straightforward to diagnose. Bad cable, loose connection, failed power supply. KNX devices are built to industrial standards. They're designed for a 20-year lifespan in commercial environments. In a residential setting, they'll probably outlast the house. But if a device does fail, you replace it with the same model or a compatible one. Download the configuration from ETS to the new device and you're back up. No repairing, no reconfiguring automations. The configuration lives in your ETS project file, not in the device.
That's a huge difference from consumer IoT. If a Zigbee switch fails, you have to exclude it, include the new one, rename it, re-add it to all your automations. It's a pain.
If the manufacturer changed the device firmware or the model is discontinued, you might be starting from scratch. With KNX, a switch from 2005 and a switch from 2026 are functionally identical on the bus. You can mix them freely.
Let's circle back to Daniel's core question. Is this actually feasible for a technically minded DIYer building their own house? I think the answer is a qualified yes.
It's more work up front, it's more money up front, and there's a learning curve. But the result is a system that's more reliable, more private, more future-proof, and more satisfying than anything you can buy at a consumer electronics store. And the fact that you can integrate it with Home Assistant means you don't have to give up the flexibility and the community and the constant innovation that makes Home Assistant great.
You get the best of both worlds. The rock-solid physical layer of a professional bus system and the rich software ecosystem of the open-source smart home community.
The cost, while significant, is not insane. We're talking about maybe $5,000 to $10,000 in hardware for a whole house. That's in the same ballpark as a high-end kitchen appliance or a nice home theater setup. It's a luxury, but it's not a yacht budget luxury.
If you're already spending hundreds of thousands building a house, an extra $5,000 or $10,000 for a lighting control system that will work flawlessly for 20 years starts to look like a pretty good value proposition.
Especially when you compare it to the alternative, spending $1,000 on consumer smart home gear, dealing with flaky connections and cloud outages for 5 years, and then replacing it all when the protocols change.
The one thing I'd add is that this is not an all-or-nothing decision. You can start with KNX for the hardwired infrastructure, lighting and blinds and heating, and still use Zigbee or Z-Wave for the more ephemeral stuff like battery-powered sensors and smart plugs. The systems coexist fine under Home Assistant.
That's actually the most pragmatic approach. Go wired where you can, go wireless where you must. Wired for anything that's in the walls and should last decades. Wireless for things you might move around or replace every few years.
Daniel, if you and Hannah do build that place, we expect a full write-up.
Photos of the DIN rail panel. A well-organized electrical panel is a beautiful thing.
Sloths appreciate a good panel. Lots of places to hang from.
I don't think that's what DIN rails are for.
Everything is what you make of it, Herman.
Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs approximately 1.1 million pounds, about the same as 100 elephants.
When I say I have my head in the clouds, I'm carrying a lot of weight.
That explains so much.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the clouds in the sky. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more than you know. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.